Hey folks, thanks for joining us for this bonus segment of A Radio Geekly, where we talk about geek consumerism. And if you were listening to our show, we talked about consumerism and geek culture, and the term gentrification came up, and we wanted to take a moment to actually unpack that and help define what we mean by gentrification within geek culture, because it is definitely something that is different than the actual definition of the term. So we're going to take this time to unpack it for you and give some clarification on what we mean, and hopefully to help educate all our fellow geeks out there on consumerism. So I'm just Jess, and I'm joined by collective members Jenna, Becky, Tabitha, and Rob. Hello, how is all of you today?
Hello.
I'm good.
Yeah.
No, I see you have notes there, Becky. So if you want to start the conversation.
This is what I love about Becky. Becky has got notes.
I know.
Well, I wasn't super prepared last time. And I think that it kind of showed in January's episode and at least my participation in it, because I feel like we code switched quite a bit between gentrification and the idea of consumerism. And so I think that there are a lot of things that there are reasons why that happens. And I think that exploring that within a geek lens will be really interesting in what we're here to do tonight. But I kind of wanted to start with a definition, like what is the definition of gentrification? So one thing that I noticed in looking it up online is that it is a fairly whitewashed thing. Like the idea of gentrification that has been put on Wikipedia and all of these other things is that it's an example of formerly low-income, air quotes, neighborhoods where longtime residents and businesses are displaced by white-collar workers and overpriced coffee houses. Now, that totally ignores the underlying fact that those neighborhoods are historically African American or populated by historically marginalized groups. And I think that that in of itself is emblematic of what gentrification has become to white society, and that white privilege definitely even just exists within that idea of gentrification and is almost recursive in the way that it appears in everything.
Yeah,
and so I think that's the same for geek culture as well.
I wanted to thank you for that definition, Becky. I think it helps set the foundation for using the term and clarifying what it means, because a lot of listeners were probably hearing that word and going, wait, this is not, how does this relate to consumerism within geek culture? How is this the same? Because this is not, and especially for our people of color listeners, it was probably borderline offensive, if not actually offensive to them. And so I want to apologize on behalf of our collective too, if those feelings were felt or actually came across. That was not our intention. And so hence we are adding this bonus content to clarify and to give more background into why we were using that term.
So I didn't want to interrupt you, but you had thoughts that you wanted
to... Well, I was just wanting to... thank you for the clarification, you know, of the definition. I definitely think of that as a very... kind of recent idea of gentrification. You know, gentrification is a term that's been around for decades, and it has been applied to not just our modern society, but how we look at like past civilizations too, how like oftentimes, you know, it's about oligarchy coming in and displacing and marginalizing, say, immigrants or whatever. I mean, this is all historical things that are constantly happening. But I think what's really important is, like, as you were saying, like within code switching, you know, the definition, I think, of how we think of gentrification today, especially like within the United States, is so loaded with race, and that we can't use that term in the United States without acknowledging race. And if you don't, then you are whitewashing the term gentrification. And so it's, I have to admit, like, I wasn't part of the last episode. I was listening, and I was one of those POC who was actually offended by the conversation. And I was kind of like, I understand what they're trying to say, but I think that it's just taking that term gentrification in its very generalized sense and how you can apply it to like almost any civilization. But within our modern society, within the United States, and especially we're going to be talking about American geek culture, it's like, mm-hmm. I think that it serves us best to apply our racial understanding of gentrification, because that's so important even within geek culture, mm-hmm. I believe. Like, that's just my personal opinion.
Yeah. I think that gentrification, along with a number of other terms that we may have had in our minds, like, it's switched because of not simply white supremacy, because that's a big part of it, but also that in the media, it's definitely like, you know, it means something different when it is used in the mouths and words of folks that are looking to further an agenda. And I believe that even though that may be the case, I think that the concept of gentrification, of people who are historically marginalized being forced out of a space, totally applies to geek culture. And as you said, the narrative being that we have to take a look at it with that lens of race, but also the intersectionality of classism, of capitalist culture, and a number of other like deep-seated oppressions needs to be part of that conversation too. And I think what makes it really interesting to take a look at geek culture as, you know, like perhaps something that is a colonizing force is the fact that, you know, not only is it this one thing, the forcing out of certain peoples, but also the misappropriation of stories, of making spaces less safe for folks. And I think that that's where kind of I want to, you know, talk a little more is, you know, there were really interesting ideas put forth in the last episode that if we just dug a little deeper, then we would be able to, like, you know, kind of draw out that like colonialist culture that kind of dominates everything. Mm-hmm. So one of those things was the idea of the Con PAX, the Penny Arcade Expo, that being, I think, like the idea that passes for that run out really quickly, that this was a place that felt like it was, quote, being gentrified, is not only simply, you know, a conflagration of the idea of consumerism, but, you know, what were the controversies around PAX? I remember that Gabe guy being a totally toxic misogynist, telling rape jokes, the dick wolves thing. I mean, like, this conference is blighted by like horrific toxic masculinity. And yet, you know, like part of that is that toxic masculinity is kind of appropriating geek culture in this way. So we want to talk about that a little more, maybe. You know, what are the other like opposing forces that like are taking a sort of a colonialist stance within geek culture and turning it into like a place where, you know, white supremacy flourishes, mm-hmm. or toxic masculinity or the intersection of oppressions?
I mean, we can also talk about a lot of conventions. I mean, we have our thoughts on Wizard World, and
we
so many thoughts on Wizard World and how many of those factors, misogyny, sexism, the misinterpretation of cosplay, mm-hmm. you know, cosplay is not consent, and how all of those factors weigh into these conventions that are overpriced, and how many of the artists and vendors can no longer participate because of this toxic environment. Mm-hmm. And hence there is this overarching consumerism where more and more things are being purchased, mm-hmm. at these conventions that are just, from my opinion, just terrible. Like, mm-hmm. it has nothing to do with the culture that is dealing with comic books and graphic novels and actually appreciating the art. It's mm-hmm. just the overarching, there's just so much stuff in your face and you have to spend every dollar that you have in order to actually just attend.
Oh yeah.
I mean, Jenna, I know that you were mentioning you have somebody that you know that could not afford to have their booth at a Wizard World convention now because it's just so overpriced. And that impact of now their content is not being exposed in these events and they have to find other avenues to make that happen. That ostracization, I cannot say that word correctly.
I don't even,
being ostracized.
There you go.
You got it.
Because that's all I got.
Yeah. To being ostracized out of that is, I would say, a form of discrimination. Mm-hmm. So, I've just seeing as these giant conventions are happening and unfolding and more people are attending these, it's like I feel there's a lot of that. They get blindsided just by the stuff that's going on.
The thing, and once again, like, gentrification is very much related also to class and consumers and money. So this is probably going to be more of a price issue, more than gentrification. But the thing that really grosses me out about conventions is whenever I see VIP ticket pricing for a convention, because... So you got the regular peons that only paid like the standard price, but if you're wealthy enough, you can get this special VIP, priority seating, priority lines, some have a lounge. I've heard some conventions have like an exclusive VIP drink bar for people that paid bugo bucks for these badges. And I'm like, well, thanks for the regular peons that don't have that kind of money.
They're the ones that make it happen, you know? Like, it's people paying general admission that are making it happen. And one thing that, you know, I'm glad that you brought up Wizard World and the phenomenon of artists getting priced out of a space is also, not only does it force people out, it forces POC artists out of the room, literally. It also opens them up to misappropriation and people seeing that art for that time. You know, like, there's something about the way that people remember things and the way that we misattribute inspiration and information that then creates an opportunity for the art, the stories of people who are being forced out actually to be then taken and then capitalized by white people.
Yeah, that's such like a good example of where we often, I think, conflate the terms like gentrification versus discrimination versus like classism, where all these things intersectionally happen. And so you can have gentrification happening at the same time as discrimination, and it can be two different events for two different people stemming from the same thing, right? So one example I have of that is, and Tabitha knows about this because I'm always cringing at this dude at conventions. And I think I've talked about him on the air before, but there's that guy who does the Japanese woodblock prints, and
let's not say his name because we don't need to give him
credit. I don't really know what his name is, but so he is a white person who sells Japanese woodblock prints, and it's this sort of thing where, you know, had, say, a Japanese person tried to make this before, you know, maybe they would have maybe been able to do it, but now they've been totally priced out. Mm-hmm. And he can afford to do it because, you know, he just has been around for a while, and also he's just,
He's also white?
Yeah, that too. But so he has a lot more resources. He can stay in. And so what are the Japanese woodblock prints that are being made in a traditional style? Who's consuming it? It's ultimately white people buying this white man's art, feeling as though they are buying something legitimate. And I can understand why, because they're like, oh, a Japanese artisan is doing this, but they're not the ones profiting off it.
Yeah, this guy's just a middleman. He didn't make
it. Right, and he's selling a lot of art that is not actually Japanese. You know, he's doing like airbender stuff, like stuff that is kind of on the cusp.
I see,
And so you are actually pushing out an artist of color or potential for the artist of color, because here is this person who's coming in and has more means and is catering to the white narrative that, like, hey, this is what anime is, and this like stuff that Asian people themselves wouldn't recognize. And yet he's the one making the money, he's the one getting the recognition, and he's the one allowed in the room. And so that's when I see, like, oh, here was a space that was maybe could be occupied by somebody who had authenticity with it and agency about it, and then it was taken away from them in this very whitewashed way, where it's like, oh, look how pretty this is. We're doing this. This is about Asian appreciation, stuff like that. And you're just like,
Well, it's also something you see with art brokerages in town. Like, I recently was sent a picture of somebody, probably white, who was selling African handicrafts, mm-hmm. and on the side of their van was a vinyl sticker that said "Get Tribal."
Ooh.
And I was like, "You have to be kidding me!" Like, and catering to the white narrative of exoticism, of tokenization, like that—that's the thing that people need to be aware of as well. And not simply that, but like the misappropriation of things too.
Yeah.
Like bringing, I think one thing that's a really fertile ground for discussion in this way is how hip hop was transformed into nerdcore, which is dominated by primarily white rappers mm-hmm. talking about nerd things. You know, I love, who is it? The one that does the Adult Swim stuff.
MC Chris,
yes. I thought, like, he's usually, like, super hilarious and stuff, but there is a trend amongst people that are making that sort of music of, you know, being in positions of privilege and utilizing an art form that is traditionally one that is outspoken and powerful against the oppression of people of color.
Yeah, I kind of wonder... if we're just talking about nerdcore music in general, mm-hmm. why aren't there more POC musicians? Because I am sure that there are POC geeks out there that have lots of musical talent, but I'm sure they're out there trying to get their music out there, but mm-hmm. why is it that these white artists are the ones that are getting invited to cons and performing at conventions and not these other POC musicians?
That's a good question.
Well, and then another question I have is getting back to kind of like what Becky was focusing on of just, why is it so many white people? Yes, but I also wonder how many POC want to participate in it? Because right. sure. I think of nerdcore as an extremely unwelcoming white space. One thing I don't like about how they treat hip hop is that oftentimes, I believe in geek culture that hip hop is often treated as ironic,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like, oh, look, we're going to be nerdy and do nerd raps. And while we understand the humor maybe in that like juxtaposition, mm-hmm. Even when they're doing it seriously, the irony is part of it. It's part of the genre for sure. That's so cringy to me where it's like, wow, the origins of hip hop are about empowerment, you know, mm-hmm. and that irony is a privilege to be able to have because hip hop is not ironic. It is full of
social
expression.
Commentary.
It's full of pain. Mm-hmm. It's full of historical trauma. It's full of, you know, historical empowerment.
Mm-hmm.
And then to have people oftentimes like even try to attach their own oppression to it or their struggle
yeah.
or attach irony to it. It just...
MC Paul Barman is a super good example of that for sure.
It's cringy,
like,
you know?
And almost like highly misogynistic for sure. Mm-hmm. I agree. Cringeworthy. I think I wonder how much of that is part of the like social capital of othering, like that geek culture is so very much like kind of brought into, you know, mm-hmm. like focus because now you're the other, you're interested in something that's not highly popular, yeah. it's made fun of. And, you know, that there is this like switch of identification amongst people who don't realize that they have privilege, but are feeling underprivileged because they like are a part of this, like I'm a nerd, I'm a geek, and I have this specific social capital of being into something that's different and cool according to me and I don't have to share and blah 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 mm-hmm. and then having that be the switch
yeah.
where you're like, oh yeah, I am oppressed actually because like I'm a nerd.
Yeah. You know, and we don't have a really healthy way in our culture to deal with feeling othered, right? Like mm-hmm. within white culture that's a big problem too, right? Like it's not just that minority, you know, people of color feel otherwise, but that the extension comes from whiteness, where there is a huge emphasis, I feel, within like our whole, you know, puritanical culture here in the United States with yeah. our Judeo-Christian culture of being the same, you know, and like not being too different. And you know, that's why we have suburbia and stuff like that. Everything's about looking mm-hmm. the same. And so there isn't a way to embrace, hey, you're an other in our culture. And so what do? White supremacy looks to, well, who's struggling? How are they doing it? Okay, let's just copy mm-hmm. that.
And I find that a really interesting irony with geek culture, because geek culture focuses, there's so many stories about being other, like aliens or robots,
yeah,
or
everything.
Yeah. And so I find it's interesting that there's this sameness in geek culture when all the stories are about being other and how you function or react to a situation, yeah, while being other.
Well, I think there is a mechanism for adopting being other. It's just the worst mechanism available. It's purchase and copy.
Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. And, that's what the consumer thinks. Active, like, oppression and stuff, you know, like because I don't think that it's, I don't think it's coincidence that this sort of othering, I think, mirrors in my mind the development of whiteness, mm-hmm, in American, yeah, culture. Like, I think that, you know, the idea that we're removing, like, you know, specific cultural identities so that people who exist in a working class, lower class kind of way to identify with people that have power is similar, oh, yeah, to this. Mm-hmm. And the whole, I think, you know, there's a bunch of mechanisms behind that, but the one that's in play in both of those is capitalism.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry, capitalism.
Cha-ching.
Down with capitalism.
No.
The profession that comes to mind is cool hunting. I'm like, that is so coded for,
that's disgusting.
Go find something that's just other enough, but not too other.
Wait a minute. For those of us who are not familiar with this term,
cool hunting.
This sounds like hipsters.
Oh, no. There is a documentary from, I want to say, like the late
High
90s
five,
from MTV about quote unquote cool hunters. And these guys will go and they'll go into middle America, see what the kids are doing, basically take photos, record, document, and then use this as feeder material for the next release of product.
I didn't see that documentary, but I did see
disgusting.
I did see a Frontline documentary. This is from like 10 years ago, but it was called like The Creators of Cool, and it was all about like marketing.
Yep.
And
I think
how,
that's the one.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, folks are can go to the Frontline website to stream that. Cause,
Creators of Cool?
Yeah, yeah. Or it has,
or
cool,
Merchants of Cool.
Merchants of Cool, yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
To find out how uncool those people, yeah, who are collecting the information,
I mean,
are.
Even though all the marketing, all the stuff that they're talking about is like, this document is from 10, 15 years ago, so it's outdated to us, but I think a lot of the ideas of how marketers work still apply, and that these people go out, see what the youth are into, and then market that stuff right back at the kids, mm-hmm, and then just creates a cycle of like marketing and being, you want to be edgy, but not too edgy that people are going to be afraid of you, mm-hmm, but they'll be edgy enough that it'll be like, ooh, it's exciting. And
mm-hmm, an example I'm thinking about right now is, have all of you seen The Last Jedi?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
No.
How the whole, you have not seen The Last Jedi. Okay, I'm not going to give you any spoilers.
Whoa.
But the characters of the Porgs, mm-hmm, were basically, from a lot of people's perspectives, were just made as a character to create toys for kids.
Tickle me Porg.
As a toy, yeah.
As a toy.
And I want it yeah, so bad, I admit it.
Right. So it's like,
so
they
cute,
had no, they had no functionality in the overarching storyline.
And people complained about the Ewoks.
Right, right. But it's just, it's just another thing of like, oh, what can we make that's stuffed? Oh, let's make a Porg, a space penguin. Sure.
Is that what it is? A space penguin?
That's, yeah, my definition.
Oh my God, I want it even more now.
But I heard they were, Porgs were the result of it being way too expensive to edit out the puffins that,
correct,
are native to.
Correct.
To,
that is the true.
But happy byproduct,
oh,
is,
right,
tickle me Porg.
Right. Exactly.
Oh. Fascinating.
Yes.
Wow.
That's interesting.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it is still true to form that, what are the kids into? Small stuffy things.
Yeah.
With big adorable eyes.
Right.
Well, that's the mechanism of the spectacular society for sure. How do you create a method by which we communicate with one another that's predicated on material and social objects?
I'm talking about like controlled messages to kind of get back to this gentrification thing, and why I found our last show kind of cringy to listen to. I wanted you guys, well, because I was listening to the show, and I wanted you guys to touch on what that's not so much about its intersection with like consumerism, but about what is gentrification. Because once you guys brought up the term, I was like, oh my God, they're going to bring up gentrification within, you know, geek culture. And then it ended up being more of a conversation about consumerism, because I think it's so important to talk about where we actually see gentrification happening, right? Like, so, and just in the comic book stories, like freaking Superman and Captain America.
I was thinking about Superman because Superman was actually created by two Jewish guys, and he's become like the symbol of like truth, justice, and the American way. And like he was originally created as like an immigrant allegory, because these guys were Jewish were from a Jewish immigrant background, and they were putting their experiences on ink and paper. And now he's become the symbol of Americana. And so I definitely feel like that's kind of an example of gentrification and definitely whitewashing. How even though he was never coded as Jewish, but he has become
like this sort of origin story that comes.
And then it's so many like layers on top of that, right? Because like we always want to say, oh, the American story is about the immigrants and we're all immigrants. Oh my God, it drives me nuts. Right. But then like, what is that? That's really a gentrification of like the first gentrification that happened in this country where we're like, oh, there's nobody here and we could improve the land, right? So let's just like pretend that Native people were never here. Let's pretend like their story never existed. So let's say, what is an American hero? It's Superman. Mm. It's Captain America, right? It's these very white narratives where we say, what is it to be an American? What is all American, right? So I just look at what are our most popular comic stories, and to me, it just reeks of gentrification. It's like, who are our real heroes? Who is this?
If there are any indigenous comic artists out there, make us an indigenous.
Well, there are so many. That's the thing, right? I mean, we had that show where we talked to people from Indigenous Comic Con, right? And like, I'm like, wow, how do we elevate those stories to the top? Do we say like, there's our Superman. That's what we need to be heading towards in the United States, where we say, these are our real heroes. These are our real stories. Let's stop putting the beautiful shiny apartment out, which is aka like Captain America in his new way too tight outfit. Anyhow,
I'm gonna complain about the tight
okay
outfit.
It's just me. I don't know, I guess I want everybody in long flowing robes or something. I want everybody to be a wizard.
That's fair.
Yeah, like I dig the Ringwraith costumes. But yeah, just those sorts of things where you're just like, oh wow, this comic culture is, you know, United States, and it's very much embedded in white supremacy and like how we choose to start, where is the American narrative? And like, that's where the gentrification comes in. So you can't erase that from when you go to conventions and the consumerism, and that's where it's all coming from, right? It's like, all of this is an attempt to erase indigenous and native voices and to attempt to say, this is our land. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, ouch, cringy.
Yeah, and also to appropriate historically marginalized African-American communities. Mm-hmm. I would like to point out like any sort of post-apocalyptic kind of spot that you see in comics or TV or movies or games or anything, it's all based on the idea of urban blight.
Yep.
You know, cyber, like Shadowrun kind of stuff. Like all of that is an appropriation in order to further the white narrative, I think, of, you know, like there's this morality tale that's associated with that. That's the case with the comics too, you know, like, oh yeah, like, you know, victory over adversity, you know, me, a white person, like within this place of privilege, being able to really like, you know, arise and, you know, meet heroic success, or, you know, being able to like, you know, extricate myself from the urban blight, this post-apocalyptic world, in order to have a better life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the same narrative. It's the same one across like American like geek culture in this way. And then you even have, you know, aside from the misappropriation of things like Native American folklore of anime, you know, you have even places that, you know, people want to participate that aren't necessarily like, you know, misappropriated, like steampunk, for example, is a place where like a lot of people that I have noticed are either white or like it is a aesthetic that is co-opted by white supremacists, like for real, like Stormfront. So like, you know, how are we, you know, ignoring this particular narrative in geek culture, that's the gentrification that I kind of want to talk about in this way.
Mm-hmm. I just think about a lot of these movies that are coming out that are adapted from historical times or from folklore and things like that. And it's white actors and actresses playing these roles, mm-hmm. you know, and it's just baffling to me because it seems like the media, especially Hollywood, figures in dollar signs, mm-hmm. not in actual like truth to the storyline. Mm-hmm. And how so much of that has been pushed in people's faces that they're just not aware of actually educating themselves.
Of course, yeah.
Or the folks that actually are educated in that, their voices get pushed down.
Yeah, or it's privilege, it's white privilege.
Yeah.
Like being able to, like, you've never experienced being forced out or being oppressed or, like, you know, not being welcome in a space, so you have no idea. And so, like, it isn't so much that we lack the institutions to teach us, because that's a definitive truth. But it is also one that is a self-discovered thing, and that, you know, folks within geek culture, like, I don't feel like have that specific vocabulary and lens. And so, you know, if you have this like majority sort of artificially created white demographic that's consuming like all of this stuff, and here's, you know, like that part of consumer culture, because that is speaking to the mainstream. And so the thing that was initially not discovered, but created as an other kind of thing, this otherness has now been co-opted by the mainstream in order to create white only spaces. I mean, like, that's the nature of entertainment in America. That's the nature of fashion. That's the nature of, like, any sort of creative expression mm-hmm. in that way.
Yeah, I think it's interesting you brought that up, because, like, I guess I haven't ever in my mind applied the term, like, gentrification, because I always think of it so much as just, like, housing. Mm-hmm. But if we're extending this term here, to extend it into, like, the whitewashing of, like, Asian roles, like, recently. Oh, mm-hmm. Natalie Portman, come on,
no
girl.
Way.
Oh, girl.
Yeah.
Right? Why are you doing that? But that. Oh, yeah. No. Annihilation.
Oh, Annihilation.
Mm. Yeah, it's Annihilation.
Annihilation is a movie that's coming out, and the character that Natalie Portman plays was originally in the book is an Asian character, and she's now playing it. And, you know, it's like when I apply gentrifications, I'm like, oh my God, because we always just call it whitewashing in mm-hmm. the Asian land. We always like, oh man, they whitewashed another role. But it is feeling forced out in a way that feels like gentrification, right? Because when gentrification happens, right, then the developers and whoever comes in, they earnestly probably believe themselves, or like, we're just trying to improve the neighborhood.
Yeah.
Like, it's not as though we hate you. It's just, you know, we're just trying to make things like shinier and cleaner or whatever. And it's like, oh God.
Right.
But so when you're bringing in a white person into a role that is obviously supposed to be played by somebody else, you're saying, oh, look at this shinier, cleaner version. And so much of the time the media wants to say, like, oh no, it's just a character, you know, it could be played by anybody. It's not something specific. But then as an Asian person, all I can see is all I hear are the racism and the racist things I've been told my whole life. Like, my eyes aren't big enough to be on camera, because I was an actress for a while, and I was always kind of being told this, like, your eyes aren't big enough, you're gonna have to open them more, right? That you're like, you're too dark, or you're too this, you're too that, you're not enough, right? And so you're constantly being told you're not enough, and then they bring in like the prettiest white lady in the world to do all the, like, Scarlett Johansson or Natalie Portman, mm-hmm. and you're like, oh, we're looked as though we are dirty, like that we're less than, that we can't even represent ourselves, that we couldn't tell the story mm-hmm. good enough, so we better bring in something shinier, more modern and new,
right?
To tell your story and make sure nobody knows that the Asians were involved. Let's just like make it all look like it was shiny and new right from here, and like mm-hmm. not even care if the Asians want to be there, right? If they want to be part of the story, because that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. And so it's just gentrification in that sense, if we're extending it beyond housing.
Yeah.
And it's painful. Mm-hmm. It is definitely painful. And it's just like so painful to listen to geeks constantly be so apologetic. Oh no, Jenna, you don't understand anime. I'm like, oh, are you Japanese? So you understand what that's like to be erased and like to have to watch weeaboos always tell me how I should appreciate them. Like,
right.
Don't, no, you just sound like a crazy developer. Don't.
Right. You're not making it better. You are making it worse. Yeah, you're taking the people out of their spaces.
Yeah, and you're not listening to why people don't want to be removed and why we feel removed. It's like you're just telling us, like, you're not removed. Mm-hmm. I'm just building a huge building.
I'm just making it better.
Now, I haven't seen Hamilton. Has anybody seen Hamilton? Because as I recall, no, that
you cannot get tickets for Hamilton unless you right, right. somebody.
Hamilton, I have to say, is one of those pop culture phenomena that I have not. I kind of like, whether intentionally or subconsciously, just sort of haven't really jumped on the bandwagon.
Maybe it's because you know you can't get tickets until the year 3000.
That's true. Maybe I know. Because of how exclusive it is, I'm like, why even try?
No, the lead actor in Hamilton, who plays Hamilton, is African American, correct?
Yes. Or
no one. Lin-Manuel?
Lin-Manuel Miranda? Yeah, he's Cuban?
Cuban? Oh. Okay, but a person of color.
Wait,
that's,
I want to look this up so I don't
so, yeah. yeah. So I'm just...
No, I think you're right. I mean, like, I think that's... he's the playwright as well. Yeah. I think the director and then plays the starring role.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah. Okay. Because I'm my marketing brain is thinking about, okay, so we've got a norm, and then outside of that norm, well, the norm is whitewashing or, you know, deeper references to removing people of color, placing in what acceptable norms in acting right now, which is clearly racist. But then we've got outliers such as Hamilton, which have huge success, which go the opposite way. And generally, if memory serves correct, Broadway informs upon sort of the early trends that have not yet hit movie cinema. So it's potential that we'll see more of that based on the marketability of Hamilton, to put it in the most horrible terms.
I have feelings about that scene, because I have feelings about Hamilton.
Lin-Manuel is Puerto Rican. Okay.
So
mea culpa.
My feelings about the Hamilton are that I really appreciate what's been done there. I mean, it's amazing how they've like taken such a strong stance where they're just like, look, we are putting out a call for POC actors and we are not being apologetic about it at all. Mm-hmm. And it is awesome to see how popular it's getting. At the same time, while I follow Broadway, I see which shows are making it and what shows are not. And while Hamilton is written by POC and stars POC, it's a story about white people and white people enjoy watching that story. Now, okay, not as well written, I will say. The Japanese American
Allegiance.
Wow, the Chinese girl remembers more than the Japanese person. That's great. So Allegiance, which had George Takei.
Yeah, exactly, because it has George Takei. Yeah. Who heart.
Oh no, but now he's on the cringy thing. Anyhow, total side. But you know, when POC tend to write stories that are for us and are about us and are exclusive stories, they often don't make it on Broadway. The stories that make it are the ones that are white focused and white centered. And so it doesn't surprise me that Hamilton made it, because it's a story that's familiar and safe to white people, but with a twist. Oh, with a twist.
Right.
And so it's like, yes, this is an important discussion. We need to have casts that are all POC, but look what it takes to do that for it to succeed. You have to take white narrative, make it ironic, right? But you can't have POC telling their own story and having white people wanting to sit in those audiences, support it, and be like, oh, this is our history too that we contributed to. I mean, It's cringy. At the same time, it's yay.
Wait, does Hamilton not even serve as purpose, like boiling the frog? So you can't, you know, the boiling the frog, you can't just throw a frog into a pot of boiling water. It'll hop out.
Yuck.
You know, who doesn't like frog stew?
I mean, do that.
That's what's at my house.
I've had frog legs before. They were pretty good.
So what I'm getting at is Hamilton may serve a functional purpose in getting white asses into seats.
No.
I'm sorry.
Rephrase.
Rephrase.
Right, white butts.
Hamilton may serve a purpose in getting white people into the theater to see an all POC cast doing a story that's familiar. The next stepping stone in keeping them coming to those shows is then to migrate the storyline into something that is appropriately POC based.
Yeah, and that's like totally how it works. That's how it works in the United States and has always worked. And that is the most frustrating thing.
Well, if
for POC, yeah.
If Allegiant had come to Portland, I think the other thing when POC try to tell their stories is getting your community to show up as well. And if Allegiant was popular enough to get a national tour and it came to Portland, I would go there. But I'm not really sure how the Asian community, or much less the Japanese American community, showed up for showings of Allegiance.
Well, okay, so but that's getting back to like touching on who are these stories for, right? Mm-hmm. So I think all of Japanese America went to go see that thing. Every Japanese American person I know went. It was a huge deal in the Japanese American community, and we did all show up, but in order to have shows continue to go, you can't just have people who make up literally like 1% of the population and expect that they're going to sustain that. What the problem is that we need to be looking at media, all these like consumerist media, mm-hmm. and what we need is white America to say, I don't need to see myself to support a story, mm-hmm. right? Because if we want Allegiance to continue, then we have to get non-Japanese people to sit in their seats, right?
Mm-hmm. And so I'll go there.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, we got one. So, you know, so that's the sort of thing. And then to like, kind of like get back to what Rob's saying, like I understand why that happens, why those stepping stones are seen as necessary. But I also want to point out that, I'm sorry, but really only white people often say that those steps are seen as like necessary, because yeah. I feel like a lot of POC artists are like, I am tired of doing the in-between, because white people don't have to do the in-between. I just want to be seen. I don't want to have to do the, hey, let's do a little in-between thing so you feel safe, because that's not a luxury that I was ever born into. It mm-hmm. was just like, you love whiteness and you're white and you're going to do this and you're going to consume our culture and you're going to feel like it's part mm-hmm. of you without any in-betweens. And I think that's the thing where POC are feeling like uncomfortable, where they're just like in comic culture and geek culture, where it's just mm-hmm. like, I don't want to be in between. I just want to be seen for myself and then not be appropriated. But like, that's too much to ask.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also that we need to redefine the term geek, you know, and redefine the actual identity of putting yourself as I am a geek, you know, and mm-hmm. I hate using the word labeling, but to redefine that label.
Mm-hmm. Because I think we should hella talk about labeling, though, because that's why all of this is predicated on the discussion of like this like inherent racism throughout geek culture. The reason why we're talking about like, you know, this gentrification and not having a label to it and it gets confused is because we refuse to acknowledge that this is like a specifically racial thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that you're right. I think that we do need to have a redefinition of geek culture. I think it is predicated on like fragility, specifically white fragility. And if we were to omit that and to make it more about visibility and have it be a more positive thing anyway, yeah. then mm-hmm. I think we could get a lot further within geek culture, because I find that's the failing, one of them amongst many, that we are always like taking it from a negative standpoint of othering, and rather than it being, you know, something that could be celebrated, like I am different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I don't look like y'all. Like I sound different. I have a different background. I mm-hmm. have a different ideology.
Yeah. Like mm-hmm. I wish we could have a conversation within geek culture that is similar to the conversation that's happening at large right now about feminism.
Yes.
Right. Where it's like feminism is not about equality of everybody being the same, mm-hmm. right? It's about a recognition that like, wow, we need to talk about all the things that make up, and we need to talk about the toxic masculinity that is a part of feminism. We need to talk about how men play a role
right.
in this. We need
What's up with TERFs?
Yeah, we need to like redefine a lot of these, or make or make it very clear what these definitions are so that we can say, oh, am I that? And then make new definitions of like how people are saying, let's redefine what masculinity is, right? Like that's so much of what feminism is right now. It's like, hey, oh, wow, y'all, there was nothing wrong with women. Let's talk about toxic masculinity and how that's actually what feminism is about fighting, right? Mm-hmm. So like in geek culture, I wish we would have that larger discussion like, hey, let's just talk about whiteness, how geek culture is whiteness. It is toxic mass. It's my favorite yet least favorite intersections. Oh, so easy to identify, right? Patriarchy and white supremacy are the foundations of geek culture, and that like we're needing to fight back in that, and we're trying to do it within feminism. And it's like, hey, can we also do that with race? Can we have like serious conversations about POC are being gentrified out? Like that's just kind of how it goes. That's like a intersection sometimes with class, but oftentimes not.
I'm feeling a term coming on.
Oh, God.
Cognitive reparations.
Cognitive reparations.
Because it's what you're talking about. And we basically a major change in the mental schema or group paradigm that's agreed upon. It's not about making everyone equal. It is about basically paying reparations cognitively so that we move out of the convenient definition of, oh, equal for all, into basically acknowledging the goodness in difference. And those are two words. Goodness in space difference.
Not indifference.
I'm good. Forget y'all. I don't need to do anything.
I'm indifferent to everyone.
I'm indifferent. I'm agnostic.
Beyond what's convenient and what's safe.
Well, so I guess my question to you is, what is the reparations part of that?
The reparations part is, reparations referring to basically a debt that needs to be paid, and it cannot be paid by simply equaling the playing field because it doesn't take interest into account. This is me going back to consumerism a little bit.
I have a friendly amendment for you.
Yeah.
A reparation is actually making amends for a wrong that has been done by paying money. I mean, not simply a debt, but that, like, you know, this is something that needs to be paid because we have taken generations of Africans out of Africa and made them work under terrible conditions for free. You know, like it's not that there's a debt because, like, you know, they didn't give it to white people to begin with.
It's a moral debt.
Yeah, it is a moral. Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So what would like literally would be like a tangible cognitive reparation? I don't know if that'd be tangible.
I don't want to like figure it out.
A tangible cognitive reparation. This is weird, but it would probably have something to do with how certain words are even defined in common lexicons like the dictionary, the encyclopedia. It may extend into the normative dialogue around certain definitions like feminism, like you know, what does equal mean? How do you equal the playing field? Truly, how do you acknowledge past error? A tangible definition could be not giving equal airtime to each subcategory or group of people, but giving disproportionate or weighted, almost like you would weight a GPA, to folks that have been previously undervalued and unheard. So it's not 50-50 airtime, it's 60-40, 70-30.
I have a tangible thing want to suggest. This could be cognitive reparations, maybe unpopular amongst a certain segment of our listeners. I say let's wipe H.P. Lovecraft off the face of the earth.
Wait, but do we get to keep Cthulhu?
No, you don't.
What?
No, he's an awful misogynistic racist.
Yeah.
How about we wipe him off of the face of the earth and the mythos, and then celebrate Clark Ashton Smith, who was actually kind of cool.
Okay, so if that's the idea, I have like a whole bus full of people we could put on that reparations bus where we
wipe them off the face of the earth.
I think one really nice reparation would be maybe a POC geek con, and or like have a con that has like a sliding scale of entry.
Indigenous Comic Con.
Or
how about if you have Japanese whiplock people, you actually just accept Japanese artists and like prioritize that and recognize like toxic whiteness and stuff like that. Okay, I gotta say this. I gotta really recognize how we're failing still on Radio Geekly in this moment is that out of everybody that participates in geek culture, the people in this room are probably some of the least oppressed. That it's problematic that we are talking about the most oppressed people in our society and not including them in that conversation. And we're like making suggestions about, you know, what we should do. Yeah. And stuff like that. I mean, and it's a difficult part of our society because like we do have to have these conversations. And we don't want to tokenize people by being like, hey, give us all the answers, right? And so we do have to have these discussions amongst each other. Mm-hmm. But I hope that what our listeners at least take away from this is to go like, I'm not going to take them as the voice of authority, you know, because like, I know you guys can't see us, but in this room are white people, white passing people, and East Asians, which in this country, we might as well, East Asians pass as like white people, basically.
None of us can speak to the Latinx or the African-American.
Right, we can't speak, right. We can't speak to like Native struggle, you know, and erasure and stuff like that.
We all have like a cis sort of like appearance.
And also too, to add to that, Jenna, excuse me for interrupting, but we are not, like you said, we are not the voice of authority. Mm-hmm. And so for those folks that are listening, hopefully that they're actually going to want to research and do some more digging within themselves as well, mm-hmm. and be more advocates for people that are oppressed, or be those listeners that want to make their voices heard. And so I just want to make clear that we are having this conversation, we're having this discussion, and yes, we are just one portion mm-hmm. of the vast community that is geeks. Mm-hmm. And so
there are lots of great POC nerd podcasts out there. Go look for them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's like, so my question to everybody in the room, while I'm saying like we all shouldn't give suggestions, let's all give suggestions. What is something that you can do when you are, I don't know, going to a con or whatever your geek thing is? What can you do to kind of fight this gentrification thing? Like what? Can we fight it? Because I feel like that's something that, like, within housing, right? We're like, what can we do? The mm-hmm. system is so powerful, right? Cons are not really controlled by the geeks. They're controlled by the companies. Right. You know, it's like, we don't get to choose who tables and stuff like that. So is it the same approach where it's like, right now, gentrification is being fought by people who protest, people who are bringing it to the authorities and saying like, this is unfair. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair approach? Because I sometimes when I see like the Japanese Wiblock guy, I wish that a whole bunch of really informed white people were to go to like the people who ran that con and mm-hmm. just complain about it. And we're like, dude, this is gross. I don't want some whitewashed thing. I want authenticity. I know that this is erasing people. Mm-hmm. This is what I want. Please don't do this. This is not the con I want. And I wish people would speak up, just like people speak up about housing. Yeah. Or is that like,
I think you're absolutely right. Really interesting. I mean, like, you know, part of the thing that we also haven't talked about because, you know, of time, of not realizing it, because gentrification is this multifaceted thing, that it is also accompanied by criminalization. It's accompanied by like increased police presence. It's accompanied by city policies that create the conditions for gentrification. Mm-hmm. And that being a very deep vein of white supremacy that lives in institutional places. Mm-hmm. And so like, you know, I think that question begs sort of like, what are the other parts of gentrification that then we're able to identify and then like kind of dig our way through? Mm-hmm. So like part of the criminalization piece, you know, I hate seeing people who are the white male, like, you know, folks at cons experiencing harassment. Like that happens. Yeah. People get pushed out of spaces, like literally women, non-binary POCs, like actually pushed out so that it makes room for white men. Mm-hmm. So what if there's a roaming crowd of people that like say that's wrong and call people out on the spot? Or like, what are the like institutional barriers to entry, you know, for POC artists as an example, and demand that these cons have like, you know, a reduced rate or for free that they get to come and exhibit their art?
Or even better, this just came to mind, we should do it just like we talk about all other things that are systemic. How do you solve that problem? It cannot be from below. Mm-hmm. We need to have more representation from the top. The question is, who owns these things, right? Who owns the major publishing houses, right?
Disney.
Yeah, that was actually in the last episode too. Was like, who, Disney just buy things,
right? And you know, and then like, who are running these cons, right? And that mm-hmm. brings back to consumerism. But it's like, how different would these be if they were owned maybe by POC mm-hmm. or you know, just non-white men? You know, that when we look at who owns these things, that's the majority of who owns these and who writes the stories and who's making the most money off of geek culture, you know. So it's like, that's my answer, is we can do as many things as we want talking about the artists, but ultimately it's the decision makers. Mm-hmm. We have to get more representation, quote unquote diversity. I hate that word, but
get
whatever.
More POC people into business school, and then in 10-20 years maybe we'll start seeing more brown faces on like CEO boards.
Maybe.
Like more opportunities.
Maybe. Yeah. I mean, I don't know, because I feel like there's a lot of people in business school. It's the systemic part that keeps them in middle management, right? It's them. It's the part that keeps them as just being the managers and not being able to ones who make the decisions about who tables. There needs to be the decision makers, top level. And mm-hmm. and that only comes when POC create their own things, right? Like Indigenous Comic-Con is dynamic and amazing because they haven't tried to infiltrate a white space. They're
they just went and
they acknowledge we can't be part of this. They're not gonna let us be part of it. Let's do our own thing. And that's what you end up seeing. Like, that's who ends up rising to the top and being able to make the difference. So I guess I'm gonna put it out there. POC people, geeks,
go to Black Panther.
Start making your own thing, please. So whoever's just can start their own con, like, let's just do it. Thanks, that'll be easy.
Right. Yeah, that's not a totally humongous thing. Well, how about investors, white investors, put your money into these things? Put them into.
Oh, but then somebody else is pulling the purse strings.
Right. With no expectation of it, editorial control.
Exactly. Oh.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And there's people out there. I know there's people out there, and that's the hard thing, is we have to match those people up because come on,
I know you're out there.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the approach is absolutely correct. In POC people, you need to be content creators, and you need to own that content. Do not sell it, or if you do sell it within the community. Sell it to somebody who appreciates it and will honor the.
But that's the thing, is that you don't get to choose. You don't get to choose
unless
who
you
buys
have a really good lawyer. And there are POC lawyers that will write in all sorts of clauses for adaptations. So
that's one thing. But when it comes to consumerism, you know, when you're an artist and you're just trying to make a buck, to be honest, you're going to sell it to whoever will take it. Even if they're racist and whatever, you need to eat, you need to pay rent, you know? So it's one thing to have a fantasy of thinking that you get to choose who consumes and that you get that much control. But that's why I'm saying people from the top have to be the ones, not just the content creators. You have to have the managers. You have to have the administrators, as you're saying, putting people on boards and stuff like that.
Investors, the people. Yeah.
So a footnote would be also hybridize your income stream or revenue stream, because if you're only doing content creation, then you are forced into the corner pocket where you have to sell. But if
that's
you diversify, then it's if you diversify, then
that's just survival. Yeah. That's all that is survival. Right. And so, that's how people survive. And that's a suggestion for survival. But in my opinion, it's just POC want to stop surviving. They want to stop surviving. They want to thrive.
To be respected.
Make it rain.
Be welcome.
Yeah, exactly. So we gotta just start a whole bunch of cons that are just called
Jenny, you want to start a con?
Sure.
Sweet.
We'll call it No Whitewash Con, and Scarlett Johansson is not invited.
Boom. Well, I think that, you know, unless there are other, you know, suggestions.
No, but go back into the hey, let's just keeping ourselves accountable. I know that even if I was listening to this conversation, I'd be it's a little cringy, because we just need to keep emphasizing that the way we use gentrification in this conversation is really minimal compared to
its definition, and that is a place of privilege too.
It totally is. Yeah. Just because, like, when I think about gentrification, you know, especially in Portland, like, I think of, like, the historical redlining, right? Mm-hmm. Well, that happened in every single city, right? Mm-hmm. The redlining. And I'm like, okay, so where was that? Where do we see redlining happening within geek culture? Like, we don't, because, like, redlining is a really horrific thing that it's happening by the government, right? Mm-hmm. So that is far more than just, like, well, consumerism, well, like, right? Like, that's... gentrification on that level has a much deeper trauma and, like, historical, you know, context to it. So I don't want people to be listening to think that we're not...
Like, that we're minimalizing.
Yeah, that we're minimalizing, like, what that is, because, yeah, redlining is a big deal.
Yeah. And also bring to light, too, that we're not the end-all, be-all of the solutions.
Yeah. Oh, no.
You know, because we're actually extending this conversation with the hopes and the goal of folks listening to actually...
And if we could be,
just,
like...
Going through and just solving it all
in one conversation, that would be amazing.
Right. The world would be a much different place. There would be a much different place.
Solved at KVU.
POC and LGBT representation, all your superheroes across the board.
Yeah. We did it with cognitive reparations.
In 1 hour.
That would be amazing.
Fixed.
We did it.
Yeah, so if I could have a magic wand, that'd be great. So if you have a magic wand out there, that's my number one solution beyond anything.
A real magic wand.
Yeah, like the Harry Potter solution.
The Harry Potter solution.
Oh, you know what? He's got a magic wand and things are still all crazy. So there you go.
Yeah, I've heard some really good, like the Harry Potter solution, hamburger math recently with the Burger King.
What?
Yeah, and it's their explanation of net neutrality.
Oh, yeah.
Hamburger math and... Harry Potter magic, or the Harry Potter solution. We've come up with all the solutions.
Get me a Hermione, and then all problems in life will be solved. There's my solution. Yeah, find us a Hermione.
I'm just going to wait for the 23rd century, and then the Enterprise can fix all our problems. Humanity would be perfect at that time.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we could dive into that for hours, so that's problematic too.
Sometime soon. I wanted to thank all of you for, digging into this a little deeper. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.